Welcome to episode number 3 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, leadership, and what it takes to develop a wellness culture within your organization. My name is Conrad Weaver, and while I'm not a first responder, I've worked with first responders from all across the country for my film PTSD 911. Hey, just a fair warning about the show today. We are going to have a deep discussion about death, grief, and suicide. If you or a loved one is struggling with depression, please reach out and ask for help. If you're in law enforcement, you can call 1-800-COPLINE. That's 800-267-5463. Or if you can't remember that, just call 988. Both of these have people standing by waiting to help you. Don't struggle alone. Reach out for help because you are worth it. My guest today is Lisa Zoll. She is a licensed clinical social worker and the founder of Grief Relief LLC, which specializes in helping clients challenged by loss, grief, and trauma. She also has experience as a volunteer firefighter and EMT at the Camp Hill Fire Department, Company 14 in Pennsylvania. This experience has led her to become a trainer and volunteer for the Keystone Crisis Intervention Team and the On the Job and Offs First Responder Assistance Program, which provides mental health services to first responders. As I mentioned earlier, we have a frank and open conversation about death, grief, and suicide. I think you'll find this conversation helpful and informative. And whether you're in public safety or not, we can all use some help when it comes to navigating these transformative life experiences. Hey, if you like this podcast and think others would too, please subscribe and share this episode, especially if you know someone who would benefit from listening to the show. And if you'd like to watch the video of this interview, check out our Patreon page, where you'll be able to get the audio and video a day early. Plus, you'll be able to see all of the episodes on video. It's the only place these interviews will be available on video. Plus, we'll offer other amazing content not available anywhere else. Our Patreon members help support this channel and allow us to continue to bring high-quality content to you. Thanks for supporting the show. And now here's my interview with Lisa Zoll. Well, Lisa, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, it's great to be here with you, Conrad.
I think we connected a few months ago when we were doing an event, a screening event of PTSD 911, just over the border here in Pennsylvania. And somehow I got connected to you. I'm not even exactly sure how.
I think I reached out to you. I saw that you had done a film, the PTSD 911 film, and I think I reached out to you. I was curious about the process and the film and ended up being able to go see it and sit on your panel when we were in, I think it was Waynesboro or Chambersburg.
In Waynesboro, right. Yeah, Waynesboro. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did get to see the film and was really impressed by the content of it and how well it portrayed the different things and aspects and challenges that first responders really do experience, not just in a snapshot, but over a length of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you get involved with first responders? What's your connection there?
My connection is I was a first responder at one time in my life. So back in the early, I'm going to say late 80s, early 90s, I was a volunteer at our local fire department in Camp Hill Company number 14. And I ran ambulance calls. I was an EMT for a short period of time. I did some firefighting. And I did that for approximately 5 years, and then my life shifted and I kind of got out of it. And, you know, it was just part of something I had done. And then I was contacted to help out with the First Responders Assistance Program in our county, in Cumberland County in Pennsylvania, and by Allie Rothrock. They got a grant to help first responders, to pay for therapy for first responders, for people that needed support beyond the CISM debriefings and peer support. If there was something more that was identified as needed, they would refer folks to my practice, where I have several therapists that also work with first responders, but I do a lot of the primary work with them.
Mm-hmm. And just to let the audience know, you are a licensed clinical social worker, is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
And how did you get into that line of work? What drew you into helping people like that?
I was working as a recreation therapist at our local hospital, Penn State Hershey Medical Center. And I realized that there had to be more to what I could do. And I had had a few significant losses in my life. And I had somebody that really helped me through that. And I thought, wow, there's a name, like it was called unresolved grief. And I thought there's a name for it. And there's something that can be done to help people that are kind of spinning in that cycle of loss and not quite knowing what to do with it, where to place it, how to deal with it. And so sort of life just happened. And I ended up going back for my master's in social work in Harrisburg. They had a master's of social work program in Harrisburg at Temple University. And I did that back in 2000. So I graduated in 2003. And then I started this practice in 2019. And that was, I had worked at the med center after I graduated. I went into teaching full time for Temple, both online and at their Harrisburg campus. And then they closed the Harrisburg campus and I wasn't sure what to do next. And I kind of just thought, this is what I'm going to do. It was just like, I want to specialize in helping people with grief. And what I realized is that I was seeing people, the people that were reaching out for help with grief were people that experienced some kind of traumatic loss. So the grief is usually traumatic in some way. And it was either from suicide, which we're going to talk about a little bit, from some sort of an overdose, sudden illness or an accident. So when we look at grief, we see people, we think about older people dying and, you know, as part of the natural life cycle, but there are so many more people that die as part of that, as a result of some kind of tragic event. And so that's where we ended up pairing our practice to address not only grief, but also trauma and traumatic grief.
You know, and I know first responders, they deal with death a lot. You know, they see it when they are on scene, or and sometimes, unfortunately, they see it within their own ranks.
Absolutely.
You know, how do you differentiate between someone who is maybe a firefighter and they go to a scene of an accident and they, you know, there's a fatality at this accident? You know, how is that different or the same than perhaps someone within their family or within their own work community?
Well, I think what happens on this when they, you know, they respond to tragic calls, I think what happens is they don't have the emotional connection to the person that has died. It doesn't mean they don't care, and it doesn't mean it's not tragic in some way, you know, to go and witness that and be witness to that. But I don't believe they have, in most cases, the emotional connection that they would have to somebody in like a line of duty death or within their family. So that really has a part to play in it, how they're connected to the person. But by and large, I mean, you see some things. A lot of times the calls that bother people the most, that they say bother them the most, are calls involving children.
Sure.
And often it's because, you know, it's a child and a lot of them have children, so they can't help but to connect, well, this could be me too, or this could happen to my child. And you start to think in those terms sometimes.
And I know in the film I interviewed Dr. Phil McQueen. He talks about trauma and PTSD and how the emotion is attached to this event, and that creates the trauma, creates the PTS. Would you say that's true in these cases, you know, where there's that emotion of, oh, I picked up this 2-year-old baby girl, you know, in the car. I have a 2-year-old back home, and there's a connection there.
Absolutely. I think there's absolutely a connection between those kind of calls. And kids are just by and large harder to deal with, because sometimes we can't, when somebody that is older and has, you know, lived their life, so to speak, not to discount anything, we can rationalize. We can say, well, they lived their life. They were 75, they were 85. We can say that. But then when somebody's life is cut short, And that's not to say that 75-year-olds couldn't live a productive life into their 90s. Sure. I mean, I, my in-laws are in their 90s.
But in a way, we expect a 75, 80-year-old, you know, they've lived their life for most of their life.
And so they've had the opportunity to do things where when we look at kids, it's like they're robbed of the opportunity to do things. And then the parents are robbed of, you know, being watching their kids do the things that they, when they're born, they anticipate watching them grow up and go to school and go to college and get married. And then suddenly that's gone.
Mm-hmm. And so when a first responder is dealing with these things, what are some of the processes that you take them through to help cope or manage that, that grief or that loss, you know, especially when they're have that emotional connection to something, you know, someone on the scene?
I think what's important to recognize is that for them to come to me, there's definitely some sort of struggle going on beyond what a peer support program can do. Mm-hmm. And as we're talking about this, I'm thinking about a paramedic that I helped who his 2-year-old daughter died of SIDS. I'm sorry, she wasn't 2 years old. She was 2 months old, died of SIDS. And 2 years later, he's on a call where there's an infant in cardiac arrest. Mm. And while he was able, he managed that call. As soon as it was over, I remember him saying, I just lost it. I lost my crap after that call. And he came back to the station. He talked to the chaplain. And he said, I can't. And that was what, that was why he was referred here. So when he comes here, then we start to talk about, you know, what was the call? And what's the connection? Mm-hmm. Sometimes people make that connection on their own. Like for him, he could say it was a pediatric death that, and that was so close to what his granddaughter. Sometimes people don't always connect those calls that like they might have built up over time. So it's just an accumulation of the trauma. And there's one call that just doesn't sit well with them. But it's also connected to other calls. So we trace that trauma history. We kind of get a trauma history. And sometimes it's related to their professional work, but sometimes it's also related to their personal past. Mm-hmm. So I had a firefighter that came in. He was a career firefighter. He came in struggling with, he didn't really know what it was. He said, if I open up this can of worms, I don't know if we're going to get it closed. So he tells me all about all these calls that he's been on, tragic calls, you know, auto accidents, fires, people are dying in all of these calls that he's remembering. And his father died when he was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So I often say that what happened was there was that original trauma happened. And then like an octopus, all these other tentacles attached to that an original incident. So we dealt with those calls and then we went back and dealt with his father's death. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is like that. Sometimes it's, you know, something happened in the past that they don't connect. Like he didn't connect that how closely the trauma of losing his father was connected in some way to all of these calls. Like there was a common thread, and often there's a common thread through the calls that people are struggling with. Mm-hmm.
You know, death is such a part of life, really, mm-hmm. in a way. You know, why is it so hard for us to understand that?
That's a great question. It's a really great question. I think it's hard. I think, well, there's a couple of things I think that are hard. I think there's people don't like to talk about it. People don't like to talk about death. It's not like you go to a gathering and say, hey, let's talk about death, you know, and let's talk
it's
about
not the dinner conversation you want to have, right?
Yeah. Oh, this is what this is about. I'm out. Yeah. Right. But so I think, first of all, it's something that people don't like to talk about. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing that happens is that when something does happen to somebody we know or somebody that we love, nobody wants to bring it up because nobody wants to make that person cry. You know, like my nephew was killed in a car accident about 12 years ago. And I know like my sister-in-law, we're always like, you know, do we bring up Abe? Do we want to bring up Abe? We often do. And it's not really a difficult thing, but it is hard for people to bring up somebody who's died because what if I ruin their day? Mm. What if I ask them a question? And what if I make them cry? Mm. And we're really uncomfortable with people crying. Like people crying really takes us out of our comfort zone. So the last thing we want to do is have somebody, you know, crying in front of us. Cause then like, oh no, now what do I do? Now I broke them. What do I do?
Do you think that's actually true that it will impact someone that they don't want to talk about or hear about their loved one?
I don't. I think what people appreciate is I have a really good friend. She lost both of her children were murdered on Christmas night some 27 years ago. Mm. Wow. And Lynn talks about how wonderful it is to hear Jen and Dave's name. Like when somebody talks about Jen and Dave, it doesn't matter what kind of a mood necessarily she's in. She appreciates that people are willing to say their names and talk about them. And I learned that from her, that every time I talk to somebody about their loved one or something, I'm always asking, what was their name? What was their name? Mm-hmm. You know, and so she taught me that. Yeah, if you bring up Jen and Dave, it's not like I forgot that they died. Mm-hmm. Like right. I'll never forget that they died. So you bringing them up isn't going to make it worse. Mm-hmm. It makes it better that I know people haven't forgotten them. Mm-hmm. So,
I remember just a few years ago, my wife's mother passed away, and she and her mom were very close. And she had been battling a kidney disease for many, many years. And it was inevitable that this would happen. And my wife still, this is, I think, perhaps about 5 years ago, and she's still grieving. Mm-hmm. And it comes in waves. And there's days, I mean, she thinks about her mom every day, I'm sure. But there are days when she's just crying and she's just, you know, remembering that. And I think for all of us, you know, that kind of event will affect us in different ways. And how can we comfort someone? How can we kind of share compassion with someone that's experiencing that, even if it's years past?
Well, let me just say a couple things first. So when Lynn and I started working together about some of the issues about grief that people have, we realized that people don't always fit really neatly into the stages of grief or the tasks of grief. Not to say that there's not some merit to it, but Lynn and I, we talked about, to us, there was the event that happened, mm-hmm. the person that died in whatever way they died, the work that you do that to make meaning out of their life and to make meaning out of the loss, and then the forever. And Lynn says, you know, just because they died doesn't mean I won't love them forever. Mm-hmm. You know, there's forever grief. And I think that's true for most of us. Like, grief doesn't get tied up into a neat and tidy box ever. I don't think there's a place where I call them grief shifts, where we shift how we are grief. And so there's a time when the loss is controlling and consuming of our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't think of anything but that. So the loss and is controlling, consuming. Over time, we learn to adapt or accommodate or figure out how to integrate that loss into our narrative, our life narrative. And over time, and there's no specific time frame for that, we learn, you know, it doesn't control and consume our lives in the same way. And the memories become maybe less difficult as they did in the first place. So I know that didn't answer your question, but I wanted to kind of set that up.
Sure.
So one of the things, you know, how do we comfort people? I think sometimes, you know, there's so many cliches that people use in grief, and we've all heard them, and we've probably all unfortunately said them. And, you know, oh, it's for the better. God needed another angel. Everything happens for a reason. They're not suffering. Nobody wants to hear that. Mm-hmm. Nobody needs to hear that. So sometimes I think it's a matter of being able to just be present. Mm-hmm. and listen and just say, you know, I'm sorry that happened. And, you know, is there, sometimes even if you ask if there's anything I can do to help, they don't know sometimes. Sure. Mm-hmm. But, and sometimes it's just that presence, that of being there and holding that space with them and being able to listen and not, you know, them not fearing that you're going to run away or freak out if they say something or if they start to cry. So I think part of it is just being able to tolerate being in a space where you can be present and listen. And sometimes, even though that doesn't sound like a lot, it can be very huge.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we forget that sometimes there's a scripture verse that says, you know, those who weep with those who weep or mourn with those who mourn. I think that's just that part of being present and being there. And that means a lot. I know it meant a lot for my wife when we were going through that, when someone was just there.
Right. Absolutely. And you know, sometimes it's just about showing up.
So you do this thing called grief therapy, and you also work with first responders, and, mm-hmm. and are those two intertwined, those two things?
Absolutely. I think a lot of times we're looking at the people that come in because usually it's some sort of trauma related issue. Mm-hmm. But underneath some of that trauma is the grief. So sometimes, like I said, the paramedic that came in with the 2-month-old granddaughter that died, you know, there's grief and there's trauma in that. And I think sometimes that the grief may get sort of pushed aside and we look at the trauma more than the grief. But I think that they're very closely tied in. There's a term, traumatic grief, you know, the grief and the trauma are so intertwined that sometimes you're kind of looking at both and trying to figure out how do you address, which one do you address? Which one came first? How do you address one or the other? And I think how do you answer that question? It lands where the person is right then and there. Like, what are they presenting with? Are they presenting with, oh, I came in because my granddaughter died and here's what's happened since. Mm-hmm. Or I came in because I experienced this terrible trauma and I'm still sitting in that trauma. So I think it's hard sometimes to even separate that. But yeah, I think there's a component of grief. And I think when we see line of duty deaths, let's say, or if we, you know, when we talk about first responders, we know there's a high suicide rate or a high overdose rate. I think that that's when that stuff really hits home. That's when the grief really hits home, is when we're looking at people that have died in the line of duty, people that have died serving their community. And one of the first people I worked with was the best friend, a firefighter, and they were at a house fire. His best friend died in that fire. Mm. And so, you know, here's this guy that they lived at the firehouse together. Mm-hmm. And now the survivor is left to live there alone and is constantly reminded of the fact that his buddy's not there anymore. So I think, you know, the grief part of it. So there you have the trauma of losing him in this fire and the grief that ensues afterwards. So I think those kind of deaths are pretty powerful and pretty hit pretty close to home, because it could be any one of us.
And we touched on this earlier, but I remember when I was working on my film Heroin's Grip, and we were on a fatal overdose scene. And there was law enforcement there. There were paramedics and, you know, EMTs there. And it was just a Tuesday. And, you know, there's a body laying there. And there was even some laughter and joking around. You know, why is it that first responders kind of have that kind of reaction on a scene like that?
I think that's a coping mechanism for first responders, for a lot of people that work in those kind of fields. The one thing that first responders tend to do is compartmentalize these calls, because if you think of our brain like a waffle, you know, you have this waffle, you know, all those little craters in the waffle, and we kind of, you know, you kind of put that call in the waffle and lock it away, because if you sat with every one of those calls, you become easily overwhelmed. And I think that gallows humor is just a way of coping. Like, you're on this horrible scene and, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, you don't know what to do. Sometimes it's a lack of what to do or what to say. And sometimes it's just like, to ease the tension of it. You know, when we hear people make jokes, that sometimes they're very inappropriate, and you know, you wouldn't be telling them in front of other people. But you know, it's a way to ease that tension sometimes, and to you know, just kind of bring everybody back to, here's the job we're doing, and we're just going to keep doing it. But this is how we have to blow off some steam sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program is, you know, recently we had the loss of one of the subjects in our film, Nicole Ford, and she struggled for many, many years, you know, with depression and just all the pressures of the calls that she had on 911, and she ended up taking her own life. Why is suicide such a huge issue in the first responder community, and what can we do about it?
Boy, that's the $1,000 million question. Yeah. Why is it suicide? I think, well, you know, first of all, to address maybe the first part of that question is, why is suicide so prevalent for first responders? I think one of the reasons is there's a certain amount of helplessness sometimes that we encounter as first responders, that we can't save everybody. Mm. Yeah, we can't save everybody. We can do everything we can. We could have done everything right, and still somebody died. And so I think there's that, you keep seeing that and keep seeing that and keep seeing that. And then I think, you know, there's also a high amount of drugs and alcohol that are used by first responders to help numb some of that pain. And I part of me wonders, if does one lead to the other? Mm-hmm. Does, you know, using the alcohol, using the drugs to start numbing, and after a while that stops working, mm-hmm. and after a while, and so we sit in this pain, and the pain becomes unbearable, and maybe we don't have a support system that we feel like we can talk to. I'm guessing that just about everybody that has taken their life, has died by suicide. Any one of the people that they know would have helped them, mm-hmm. you know, oh, I wish they would have said something, we could have helped them, but they don't think, they're not sitting in their rational brain when they make those decisions. So they don't think, oh, I could reach out to Conrad, I'm sure he would help me. I could reach out to Lisa, I'm sure she would help me. Mm-hmm. They're not thinking in those terms. They're thinking I'm in pain and I want it to end. So I think that's part of what happens. And when we talk about Nicole, I think sometimes dispatchers have a really hard job because they don't get to see any outcome. Mm-hmm. Like they're there, they have the person on the other end screaming at them and crying and maybe, you know, just hysterical maybe. And they can't reach through the phone, right? Mm. Their voice reaches through the phone, but I think you must feel very helpless sometimes when, you know, somebody's calling you with an infant in cardiac arrest and you're trying to talk them through that. And I know they do that. I know they're trained and they do that very well. But when they hang up the phone, you know, what happens? Like the phone rings again and they're on to the next mm-hmm. call, and they often don't get any to hear, did the infant live or not?
You know? And that's a huge adrenaline rush, you know, in the middle of that call to deal with that. I mean, that's gotta be, I'm just thinking, I've never been in that situation, but I can imagine how that would be. And then, you know, you kind of like breathe this big sigh and then boom, the phone rings again mm-hmm. and you're immediately again, you know, activated. Your adrenaline's activated again.
Yeah, you don't have time to process any of that.
Right.
And I think that's what happens a lot of times.
You know, the other night someone said something. I was on a call with actually a suicidologist, and he said something that was pretty amazing. He said, you know, we are not responsible to save lives as first responders. First responders, they shouldn't take on this thing as we have to save lives, but the wording is we can help save lives.
That's an interesting distinction.
Yeah, because if I'm saying I have to save lives, then if I don't, I get hit with it. Mm-hmm. You know, well, I can help save a life,
and I think that's a really good kind of reframe of that. Although I think most people operate in the the area. I have to save lives, mm-hmm. you know, I have to. This is my job to save lives. But it really is more realistic to say I help save lives, because mm-hmm. certainly there are times when we come on you come on a scene and there is nothing that you can do mm-hmm. to help the person.
Right. So how do we deal with suicide?
I think this is a great start. I think, and you know, opening up that conversation and keeping that conversation open. I think it's tragic when we hear about suicide. I have folks that I work with that are dealing with suicide of like younger people, and it's they were just like, why didn't we see it? Why didn't we know what was going on? And I think part of it is that sometimes we really don't see it. And I always say it's afterwards that we kind of connect all the dots that something was wrong. But I always say you can't bet on a football game after it's over. Hmm. So there might be little indications that something's not right, but it didn't really, those little indications in and of themselves didn't add up to what turned out to be suicide. But afterwards, we can look back and say, oh, this meant this, this meant this, this meant this. And that makes us feel even more helpless sometimes.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, this awareness, Conrad, that you're bringing to Nicole's story will bring, you know, you have a platform mm-hmm. that you're able to now to use to address, you know, the PTSD 911 is addressing the trauma that mm-hmm. that first responders face on a daily basis. You now have another platform that you can, that will also help open up that dialogue with the unfortunate loss of Nicole. Mm. And I think that's what needs to happen.
You know, something this incident, this issue, this thing dealing with Nicole's loss, you know, has really made this whole thing more urgent for me. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that her life has meaning, still has meaning. Her life had meaning mm-hmm. and her life still has meaning, you know, that the story of her life. And we had a screening of the film just recently. And a gentleman came up to me afterwards and he said, I never met Nicole, but she saved my life. I said, well, please tell me, you know, how. And he said, she was on a podcast some years ago, telling her story and the process that she went through. And he said, that helped me to get help. And so she actually saved this man's life.
And that's a credit, you know, to her and to the work that she was doing to get out, you know, the message that mental health is important. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when we think about suicide, you know, we think about, there's the stigma. Again, mm-hmm. there's the stigma of mental health, there's the stigma of suicide, and there's a fear. Like, if it happened to her, it could happen to me. Mm-hmm. And I also think that, you know, that fear keeps us from doing things we shouldn't do, and sometimes fear keeps us from doing things we should do. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yeah, her, the meaning that will come out of her loss is already becoming evident, and I'm glad he shared that with you and was able to share that with you. And then hopefully you're able to share that with her family, because I know you said you've had contact with them.
Yeah, I did. In fact, that night I immediately sent a text to Nicole's mom and just shared that story with her. And she was so grateful to hear that.
Absolutely. And I think one of the other things that when we think about somebody, you know, a tragic death, like a death of a suicide or by overdose, you know, that is one moment in their life that was mm-hmm. very unfortunate. That's not what defines them. You know, right. We're looking at what defined Nicole was her life as a 911 dispatcher. I believe from the film, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, she worked, you know, during the Boston bombings. Mm-hmm. And then I remember her, the film, what I remember distinctly about her is that she was always carrying a camera around. Yep. So she got very into mm-hmm. photography. So there's Nicole died by suicide. That's this, this part of her life. That's this one thing that happened, and unfortunately tragic thing that happened. But there's so much more of Nicole's life that we need to focus on and celebrate and remember. And, you know, that's what helps make meaning out of somebody's life. Like him sharing that story with you helped add meaning to her loss, for you, for her family, for him.
You know, after this happened, I was talking with a friend, and we were talking about, you know, okay, how do we share this information with the audience, you know, with our film? And someone said, well, if she would have died in a car accident, if she would have been killed in some other way, you know, natural causes, we wouldn't even be talking about this. Why is it that this one thing, suicide, has such a stigma and carries such a kind of a gut punch?
Well, I think when we look at car accidents, that's the word. It's an accident. Like, there's this sense of a moral failure of some kind. And I'm not saying it's a moral failure. I'm saying that's what people sometimes view suicide or substance use as, a moral failure of some sort. It's not. It's people are in a lot of pain and struggling, and they don't see any way out of it. So I think because it's an act that is usually somebody takes their own life instead of having their life taken from them. And I think that's what we see, is that we can't wrap our mind around that. If we've never been in that dark of place, I think we can't wrap our mind around how could somebody do that. And I think so it doesn't make sense. And we are people that want things to make sense. And if we could say, well, here's why they did it, I don't think we would still accept that very well. You know, I often talk to people about where they have somebody that's been lost, and there's always that question of why and what could I have done differently. People are left feeling guilty. There's a lot of emotions attached to a death, you know, in and of itself. But then if you have a death by suicide, you have even more questions about, you know, you feel that, what level of guilt, what could I have done? So I think that it makes it that much harder, because sometimes people take on that personal responsibility of that they should have, and they couldn't, but they feel like maybe they should have done something or should have seen it. But, you know, we can say, yeah, maybe other people had eyes on that person. You know, there were a lot of people in people's lives where they ended up taking their life. There were a lot of people that had eyes on them, and there were a lot of people that didn't know that they were struggling because they didn't share it.
Sure. So let's take it to the living. How do we work with, how do we help someone who has perhaps some suicidal tendencies or has indicated that they're tired of living?
So there's a couple things and that's scary to hear. So there's a couple things to take into consideration. One of them is, are they suicidal, or do they have suicidal ideation? So there's a difference. So if somebody with suicidal ideation may be thinking, the world would be better off without me. My family would be better off without me, but I'm not going to do anything to further that. I don't have any means. I don't have a plan, and I'm not going to do it. So there's that difference, but it's still alarming that some people might think that could be a possibility. And then we have the people that are truly suicidal and truly want to take their lives. So what do we do? You know, that's a great question. One thing we do is we make sure that, I know with first responders, they have the peer support program. So there has to be people that can be trusted. And it doesn't have to be a colleague. It can be a family, it can be friends. But by and large, people that fare best when they're struggling with any kind of mental health or illness of any kind are people that have a strong support system. So we want to make sure that we're that we're supporting our first responders. And, you know, who is supporting them? Like, you have the your family that supports you, but you want to hide stuff from them. You have your colleagues, but you want to hide stuff from them. So I think one of the things that we need to figure out is, are there people that they can go to that they can trust that are not going to throw away the key, so to speak? You know, I think a fear, one of the fears that first responders have is that they will lose their job. If they're suicidal, you know, for a police officer, they're going to take their gun, they're going to lose their job. For people that are EMS providers or work in a corrections officer or whatever, you know, I think there's that fear of losing their job if they admit that something is wrong. So I think part of it is, again, is addressing that stigma of, you know, it's not your, it's something that needs to be addressed. It doesn't mean that it doesn't mean you're broken. It doesn't mean you can't heal. It doesn't mean you can't get better. In fact, a lot of people do get better, but sometimes people lose. I think there's a loss of hope sometimes. And I think you know, how do we instill, or how do we find places where there's hope to be had?
The other night in the conversation I had with the suicidologist, he was saying how, you know, we can speak directly to the person, speak directly to the issue. And he recommended don't ask the question, are you going to hurt yourself? Because that's kind of an out. Ask directly, are you thinking of killing yourself? Because he said, oftentimes a thought of suicide is all in the head. It's all in here. So you're just churning this and you're churning this. And so then when you have to speak it out, it's like, oh, yeah, I really don't want to do that. You know, or maybe, yeah, I want to do that. But then you think, oh, man, I just said this out loud.
Yeah.
And it kind of brings it to the surface, and it forces the person to really deal with it and to talk about it.
Well, that absolutely makes sense, because in the past, we used to think, if we ask somebody if they're going to kill themselves, are we planting a seed? And they found, you know, through years of research, that is definitely not the case, that we should be very, very direct when we ask people. So maybe it is like, you know, if you notice somebody that you're working with and you see them struggling, maybe it is that you do have to ask that question, as uncomfortable as it is, and they might not like it. But, you know, if you have, sometimes our gut tells us things before our mind really registers them. And maybe we know people, you know, these first responders work together for years sometimes, or they have partners they work with forever. And we know, you know, when something's off, or you might know of their personal struggles. You know, how do we help that then? How do we transfer that compassion that we have for each other into, you know, asking those questions, those tough questions? And those are tough questions to ask. And I mean, it's kind of awkward sometimes. I mean, we ask it all the time in our office, and I'm always like, you know, I got to ask this to try to smooth the edge of that question off. But I said, I have to ask this. And, you know, they're tough questions to ask.
Yeah. And I've had to ask that of people before, and it is not fun. It's not a fun, pleasant thing to think about, you know, to have to ask that question. But I think you know, whenever I ask that question, it brought some consolation to me. It helped me understand, okay, what this person is really thinking. And it kind of helped me to take, okay, what's the next step with this person? What's the next thing I should do? So let me ask you that. What is the next step? If they say, no, I'm not really, that's not something I'm thinking about. Or if they say, yeah, I've thought about this and I have XYZ in place.
Well, and I mean, I've been in that position both ways. When somebody says that, yes, they do have a plan, I mean, or means, you know, we're trying to contact people in their family then, or somebody close to them, and say, you know, I have so-and-so in my office and this is what they're saying. We try to do it with, of course, with their permission. Can you get the guns out of the house? Can you get the pills out of the house? You know, can you, are, are you going to be home when they get home? You know, do we need to, you know, what kind of support can we put in place to keep them safe? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, maybe you don't have the option, you don't have an option. Maybe you have to call crisis, or maybe you have to involuntarily commit them unless they're willing to go to, you know, an emergency room or something. Mm-hmm. I know that most places provide crisis numbers for people if they need them, that, you know, 24-hour crisis lines. We have often referred, and I know probably the emergency rooms don't always appreciate this, but if somebody is in that kind of distress, then certainly going to their nearest emergency room. I mean, you hear that on everybody's voicemail. If you call any office, it doesn't matter if it's like my office or a doctor's office, you know, you always hear, if this is an actual emergency, please hang up and dial 911 or go to your nearest emergency room. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's one thing that you can do. The other thing, I guess, you know, if they're having those thoughts, that's significant. Even if they're having the thoughts, but they're saying, I'm not going to hurt myself, that's still pretty significant and possibly a symptom. Symptomatic of a depression or anxiety or post-traumatic stress. And, you know, maybe that's where you reach, you know, there's companies have EAP sessions. They have, you know, help. Can you help them find, you know, somebody that they can talk to quickly?
Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do if someone is in such a dark place that they don't have the energy even to say, yes, I'll go talk to someone? But they've kind of exhibited these thoughts of suicide, but they're not really even willing to go to see someone or talk to them.
And well, that's a tough question. I think I think that at some point you have to make the decision whether they actually need to be, quote unquote, forcibly taken to someplace, like involuntarily, I guess would be the word, taken to someplace. Like, do you call the police to do a wellness check, and or do you make sure that they're not alone for a period of time until that can happen, until, you know, they can get help, or till they kind of, sometimes people will be in that dark place and maybe will kind of come out of that. But other times, you know, it can take therapy, it can take medication, sometimes it takes hospitalization, or, you know, or outpatient therapy, or all of the above. You know, there's not just one thing that helps everybody. There's a lot of different things that I think play a part in helping someone sort of prop themselves back up. And so I think, you know, it's not just, there's not one single thing that we do, but what are their resources? What resources they have? Are they connected to a church? Are they connected to, you know, any kind of family, of friends? Are they connect? You know, where are their connections? Who are the people or things that prop them up? And how do we utilize those resources and strengths to help get them through that period? And at some point, they probably are going to need help. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you know, some people are mandated to go to therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you can't come back to work until you get some therapy.
Right.
So, I mean, sometimes they want to just check that box. And but does it keep them safe? Well, if it keeps them safe, then okay, check the box.
So what if it's me? What can I do if I'm in that place, in that dark place? And what's the first step?
First step for you, I'm guessing that your wife would notice that you were not doing very well. And I'm guessing
sure she would.
And sometimes people start out by, you know, saying, let's talk to your doctor, like a lot of PCPs. Let's, you know, instead of going, I don't want to find a psychiatrist, I'm not going to talk to a therapist. Let's talk to a doctor. Can we at least go talk to the doctor and see what they have to say? And maybe they have, you know, they'll say, yeah, you're depressed, dude. You know, you need a little bit more help. But I think, you know, part of it is people are hesitant to talk about it. I think she would know, like, people that are close to us will notice that something's off. And I think then it becomes, you know, there's been people that come to the office that say, I'm here because my spouse told me I had to be here. You know, the other people notice. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's the extra push from somebody else or an ultimatum. Like the one person that came in, the career firefighter that came into my office was like, his wife was like, you're going to talk to somebody. I'm calling this, the, you know, the first responder assistance program, and you're going to talk to somebody or we're, you're not staying here, you know, which is kind of an ultimatum, but also it's like, oh man, I am in trouble. I need to get some help. So if it's you, Conrad, I'm going to say that, you know, you're probably going to be stubborn about going to get help. Most people are. But I'm also, you know, aware that when people are struggling with some sort of grief or and some sort of trauma of some sort, they often self-identify. They know they're not doing well. They know they're not their own, you know, their usual self. And they also know that they've been struggling for a long time. So sometimes, in theory, people will self-identify and say, oh, I felt like this for like 2 years now. It's time to do something. Or you've told somebody and they say, oh, you really should get some help.
Because or your life is going off the rails and right. It's like, yeah, I don't have a choice or things are really going to be screwed up.
Right. Like I could lose my job. I could, you know, get thrown out of my house or whatever. So I think, you know, yeah, there's certain things that you will, you know, when we talk about diagnosing mental illness or mental health problems, we talk about clinically significant distress. So people that are, that's one of the criteria for a lot of diagnosis, they're in clinically significant distress. And when somebody's in clinically significant distress, other parts of their lives are off the rails, as you said. Like I might not be able to get out of bed to go to work. I may not be able to, you know, fulfill the roles in my house. So, you know, there's really stuff that you're seeing that at some point you can't ignore. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. So, and full disclosure, I'm doing okay. I'm doing good. So
I won't call anybody.
Okay. So you deal with death and dying and grief, you know, pretty much every day. How do you take care of yourself as a therapist, as a counselor? What do you do to maintain your sanity and your health?
Well, yeah, good question. Because we're terrible at it, right? we're the ones that are always talking about kind of self-care. I have a couple things I do. I have some great friends, you know, a handful of really good friends that I can always talk to or chat with. I love to read. So I'm often in the middle of some sort of book somewhere along the way. So reading is very helpful. I have some podcasts that I like to listen to. I will now add this one to my list. And one of the things I just talked to somebody about is having things to look forward to. Like having things on your calendar, no matter whether it's a big vacation, like this person was planning a trip for 2025. And I said, you know, that's cool because you have something to look forward to. But I think sometimes it's having those little things on your calendar to look forward to. I have a friend that's going to see the movie Oppenheimer tonight. I'm like, that's something to look forward to. Like I put that on my calendar. I have a friend that's coming to visit on Saturday and we're going to spend the day together. That's something to look forward to, something on my calendar. So I think for me, it's having those little and big or bigger things to look forward to. So I think that's for me, something that's very helpful, knowing that I have things that I'm going to be doing that are outside of work and that are great distractions. I think we need distractions sometimes. So when, you know, when I get involved in a book, it's wonderful, you know, and I just can zone out and not think about everything that's going on. Sometimes, I mean, I think there's the human side of us too. And you know, therapists aren't robots and, you know, we don't have an on and off switch. We learn how to try to, you know, compartmentalize, as I talked about before, to leave the office at the office. But there are some stories that you can't help but carry with you and that you can't help but that touch your life in a way that's really, you know, you feel sometimes I know there's been times where I've felt somewhat helpless in a session where somebody's just, you know, so, you know, the story is so pretty, so horrific. that I know I've been like, I've got to take a minute and try to figure out what do I want to say next or what do I want to ask next or something. And so I think that that we learn sometimes how to kind of manage, balance some of that. But again, like for you, you know, you did this film and suddenly you have to deal with Nicole's death. And that's not easy. So there's certain stories that will stick with you and that you will sit in sometimes more than others.
So wrapping up here, if you could snap your fingers and change anything with first responder wellness, what would that be and why?
Oh boy. I think what I would want for them is to feel like it's not a weakness to get help. To feel like I can tell any of my colleagues, or I could tell anybody what I'm going through, and I would get the support I need. Like, I wouldn't feel ashamed. I wouldn't feel like I'm weak. That it would be okay to say something if I don't feel good, and people aren't going to, you know, suddenly think less of me or think of me differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be great not to have that stigma, right? Of saying, hey, it's okay. And then to know that there's hope.
And I think that's a huge thing. And I think one of the things I think is that when people do reach out for help, that's a sign of hope. Because if you didn't have hope, maybe you wouldn't reach out for help. If you didn't have hope, you'd be, you know, stuck in the bed, or you'd be sitting, you know, I don't know what you'd be doing, but you wouldn't be reaching out for help if you didn't think there was hope. And maybe people don't look at it that way, but I do. I think, you know, if you didn't come here, you came here because you thought there was hope that somebody could help you. And I think that, you know, that's huge to find some kind of hope. And I think it can be a relief to just be able to get off your chest everything, whatever this is. And I think people are surprised that that the process isn't as scary as they might think it is.
And how important is it for us to stay connected? Because I know, you know, addiction and a lot of these things, they're exacerbated by isolation. And it's often a thing. How important is it to, hey, send your friend a text message or give them a call, leave a voicemail, just to touch base with someone who's struggling?
Yeah, and I think that that whole concept of isolation, was, you know, the pandemic. I mean, we all lived in isolation during that time, and we know how we felt. And so I think, you know, that feeling disconnected from people can be really, really hard. And I think, you know, people need connection. We are human beings. We are social beings. And so, you know, when you have people reaching out to you, even if it's just that one line, hey, thinking about you, I think that's so helpful sometimes, especially when people are feeling like they can't reach out for help, or they can't,
they're the only one.
Yeah. And I think that the conversations that we can have around this topic are really important. And there's more and more conversations about it. And I think that's important. But, you know, yeah, how do we stay connected? The human connection is so important. And, you know, even though we do all these things virtually now, it's not the same as being, you know, connected and in person and being able to be in the same space with somebody else. So, you know, isolation, that's part of, they call it, I don't know, it's part of an endemic of some sort in our world. There are so many people that are, you know, isolated from people, places and things that they love. And, you know, it's a tough place to be.
Yeah. You know, being there in person, recently I was able to go visit someone who's struggling, and I had sent them a text and just said, hey, you know, how are you doing? I'd love to stop in to say hi. Is there anything I can bring you? you know, and they were like, just bring you.
Just bring you.
I don't need anything. I just want to bring you. And so I did that, and I know it meant a lot to me just to be able to go see this person. Mm-hmm. And I know it meant a lot to them as well. Absolutely. And I think sometimes that we just need to, you know, back in, when I was growing up, people would just drop by the house randomly, you know, on a Sunday afternoon. That's what you did. You went visiting your family or visiting your friends, and you just drop by unannounced, you know. And today that's become like almost verboten, you know. You don't do that, you know. Right. But I think sometimes we need to have that kind of an attitude. Let's just stop in and see this person, and you never know what that's going to do for someone.
You're right. I think sometimes people show up because they're meant to. Yeah, I don't know if it's a divine intervention of some sort or something, but you know, sometimes we just know, like we talked about that gut feeling. We have this gut feeling that we need to check on somebody, or we want to call somebody, you know, out of the blue. Sometimes it's, you know, you never know. I think the other thing to realize is that we never know what other people are going through. And we're not really good at telling people that we're struggling. Yeah. And so maybe part of the conversation that continues to go on is that we get better at least telling people, hey, I'm having a tough time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't discussed during this time?
Not that I can think of. I really appreciate the opening up this discussion. And I think it's an important discussion to continue to have among all of us. And the more we can talk about it, I know we can talk about so many things, but I think the more we are able to say about it, the more people that we're able to reach and say, please just reach out for help. Don't take that final step. There are people that care. And I think that's key. There are people that care always.
Absolutely. I know you have some resources, some books and some other resources. How can people find you? How can they find your resources?
So we have a lot of things posted on our website, which is www.griefrelieftherapy.com. So there's a lot of things on there. We have a grief book called Grief, The Event, The Work, The Forever, and that's on Amazon. And I'm currently working on a book, Living Forward for First Responders. And that is kind of in the works right now. So that will be available at some point. But we have some video clips on our website. We have a section for first responders on our website that has a couple of resources and some just basic information about treatment and, you know, what is traumatic stress, what is, you know, EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, which is an approach we use to treating trauma. So there's some real basic things on there. And, you know, if people need something, I'm willing to send things wherever, you know, if somebody thinks they need something, you know, we can certainly get information to them.
And what areas are you licensed to practice in?
Right. Currently I'm licensed to practice in Pennsylvania and Maryland.
Okay. Great to know. Well, we'll make sure we put links in the show notes for the podcast and let everybody know where they can get in touch with you. Thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I'm sure we'll have some more conversations like this in the future. So thank you.
I look forward to it. And thank you. Thank you for what you're doing to get the word out there. You've got a great platform, Conrad, to getting the word out there that this is stuff people struggle with. And I think that is important, because what you're doing gets people to what I'm doing. Right. You're putting something out there. You're putting the thought in people's minds that, oh, I'm not alone. This is happening. Oh, and there is help for me. So they might not reach out for that help if it's not for, you know, realizing, oh, this is a thing and there's help for me.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. I really appreciate it. And please leave a review and give it 5 stars if you think it's worth it. And please subscribe to the show as well. Also, just a reminder that you can see the video of this content on our Patreon channel. I'll leave a link in the show notes where you can access that. We want others to discover this content and benefit from it as well. And remember, you are not alone. And if you need someone to talk to and don't know where else to turn, dial 988 for help. That's 988. Until next time, be well. Take care of yourself and those around you. And go out and do something good in the world.